simulations of drop interface impact. Here I'm going to focus on a fluid dynamics problem, but maybe one of the things that I'd like to convey is that we developed an adaptive numerical framework that could be used to simulate many problems, interactions in biology, fluid structure interactions, and so on. So this is joint work with my colleague Vittorio Cristini, who's in the math and biomedical engineering department, his main department at Irvine. Mainly this is work of our graduate student, Xiaoming Zhang, who finished about a year ago and actually still at Irvine as a postdoc, but he's going on to Michigan next year. And important part of this work was actually done by an undergraduate from Minnesota, who's now a PhD student at Northwestern, Tony Anderson. So basically I want to focus on multi-phase flows and really free boundary problems in such flows. So basically examples are, of course, drop deformation, jets. In material science, you might have a Stefan problem, so where you have interactions between crystal growth and flow. In biomedical examples, you could have flows of red blood cells, various models of tumor growth, for example, where you use fluid dynamic models, as we saw as an example in the previous talk. Now, in the fluid flow aspect, or the biomedical aspect, really what can happen is you can have topology changes or complex interfaces as a result of the interaction between the interface separating the different components and the overall flow. So for example, you can have breakup and coalescence of drops. Typically the problems are difficult as well because they're multi-scale. So you have basically dispersion of drops, let's say on a very small scale, but that's going to affect the macro scale rheology. But the drop distribution, it depends on things at the micro scale. So for example, thinning films or near contact dynamics. So you have interfaces in near contact, the film of liquid separating them has to thin. And so you have to get that dynamics right in order to get the essentially the drop size distribution right. And then you need the drop size distribution to get the macro scale rheology correct. So the problems are really involving various length and time scales, and so they're quite challenging to try to simulate. And as I mentioned, many applications of multi-phase flows or multi-phase solvers in engineering, industrial applications. I mentioned biomedical applications, and of course microfluidics. Now, I want to present a framework for attacking multi-phase flows using an adaptive numerical approach, and I want to do it in the context of looking at a specific experiment. So it's a fundamental experiment of a drop being ejected. So basically we have a drop of liquid, it's going to fall through another liquid, so this drop is a mixture of water and glycerin. It's going to fall through an oil, a silicone oil, which is lighter, so it's going to sit on top of this liquid here, which is the same as the drop. So it's oil, water, glycerin, drop. And the idea is to do a very controlled experiment to try to understand what's going to happen when the drop comes down and impacts the interface. And this is experiments that were done by Ellen Longmire and her student Zulfa Mohammed Kasim. It was published in 2003. And so it's really a very fundamental study, well-controlled experiment that we can use as a benchmark, a very non-trivial benchmark, to test our numerical methodology. and so basically that's here. So the whole key is that to do this simulation accurately, you have a wide variety of length scales, but in particular, you have to really resolve the length scale that's the lubrication scale between the drop and the interface as they're in near contact. So let me show you what happens with the experiments. So the experiments are characterized by a bunch of different non-dimensional numbers. So the viscosity ratio between the liquids, the ratio of densities, the Reynolds number, which is measuring essentially the strength of the inertial force to the viscous force, the Weber number, which measures the strength of the relative strengths of the inertial force and surface tension force, and the Froude number, which measures the strength of inertial to gravitational forces. And I could alternately use the Bond number, but use a Froude number. So they, in the experiments, they considered two cases. One case where the viscosity ratio is 0.33, and another case when it's 0.14. So essentially what they do is, in this case, where the viscosity ratio is 0.14, so this is the drop to the ambient, just like this, but except for viscosity, that basically if you going from here to here, basically all they do is they reduce the viscosity of this oil. So here the viscosities are closer to match than here. Here the viscosity of the oil is much larger than the viscosity of the drop, and correspondingly the other parameters change. But what they're really doing is changing the viscosity of the oil. So I want to show you what happens. So what you see are titanium particles that are used for particle image velocimetry measurements of the velocity. Here's the drop, comes down, deforms the interface significantly, and rebounds without coalescence. Yeah, it's beautiful. And what happens, and then the drop bounces and will just sit there. And it'll sit there on the order of minutes before you actually have coalescence, because this liquid has to drain out. And the coalescence, what they observe is that basically at some point, typically off-center, the interface will break and the drop will then drain into the lower fluid. And it's the same fluid, drop and lower fluid.
Does drop mean touch the bottom?
Say again?
Does drop mean touch the bottom? What the movie?
So the bottom is way down here. And this is the interface that separates the oil from the water, and the drop is also water. And so here was the...
Could you show that one again?
I'll show them both again. So so let me do them both, maybe. So let me do the higher viscosity one, and the... So this one is much less deformed because it's more viscous. The oil is more viscous, and you see it deforms the interface much less, but they both rebound. And then as they're sitting there, and this one, of course, rebounds much more, and then they'll just sit on the interface, and they'll acquire quite a similar structure or shape as they're sitting there on the interface. And so now the idea is to try to capture this in the simulation, where we're doing a full continuum model, but we want to be able to capture this level of detail in the experiment. So the mathematical model is the Navier-Stokes equation. So we have the inertial piece, the stress tensor T, the divergence of the stress tensor T, and the gravitational term, where we subtracted off the the average, basically the average density. And then we'll consider the Boussinesq model. So we'll neglect, and this is reasonable because those the fluids they're using in the experiment are close to density matched. And so essentially what we're doing is we're saying that we're only considering the density variation in the gravitational term, but neglecting it in the inertial piece. We can argue that the gravity is strong enough that it would affect here, but it wouldn't affect that.
What were the density differences?
About 1.1. The ratio is about 1.1. And so these are the equations that hold in the matrix fluid, or fluid 1, and the drop fluid, fluid 2. Okay? But across the interface, it's an interface between the two fluids, and so there's a surface tension, and so that arises as a jump condition in the normal stress, so proportional to the curvature, with a constant of proportionality being this Weber number, because I'm presenting it non-dimensionally, one of the Weber. And n is the normal, outward normal to the interface. And it's viscous, and so there's no slip across this interface. It's nice that the velocity is continuous. And then the interface moves with the fluid, or at least the, so really what all that means is that the if x sigma is the interface position, then the normal component of dx dt is just u dot n. And the problem is this is a highly nonlinear, non-local free boundary problem, non-local through the incompressibility condition. So there have been many methods that have been developed to try to solve these problems. So ranging from boundary integral methods, where these are very accurate methods. They require special, not geometry, but special flow conditions. For example, you can apply them most naturally in the case if you had no inertia, so you were very viscous flow, or fully inertial with no viscosity. But when you're in intermediate ranges of Reynolds numbers, you basically can't do just boundary integrals. You have to include some volume components as well, so limited physics. But these can be made very accurate. Meshless methods, so particle methods, basically, marker point methods. Diffuse interface methods, which are based on phase field formulations, tracking volume fractions, for example, and giving interfaces finite thickness. Front tracking methods, where you essentially embed, have a separate mesh for the interface, and you let the interface mesh move through the volume domain, which is meshed using a different technique. Volume of fluid methods, where what you track are explicit layer volume fractions, so you make sure you conserve always mass. But the problem here is since you're tracking volume fraction, it's hard to reconstruct interfaces. And then the level set method, which is very well known here and many other places, but especially here, where you can it's easy to compute the interface geometries. You have to be careful about mass loss, essentially, because it's not explicitly conserved. But you, like these other methods, a number of these other methods, it's, for example, the volume of fluid, the diffuse interface, also the mesh-free methods, you can have automatic topology changes. So that's an advantage, of course. And now, of course, the trend in methods is really to develop hybrid methods. So you combine the good features of various methods. For example, combining level set and volume of fluid method, where you use level set to get good information about the interface, interface geometry, but use the volume of fluid to try to correct the loss of mass. Also, marker points and volume of fluid methods have been used, and so on. Now, in many techniques, there have been developed adaptive mesh. They've been developed in conjunction with using adaptive mesh. So the main types are doing moving meshes, where the meshes move around. And for example, you can use mesh mapping to do problems like that, locally refined mesh, and so on. So the point is that there's been many, many problems to try to, many methods to try to attack this problem. But yes.
Before we go on to the numeric,
yeah.
I want to just make sure that I understand the physics. So the reason that the fluid tube, the drop that comes down, is not actually, is separated from the fluid tube in the bottom, is because you have a thin interface of fluid one.
Right.
And the, okay. So
yes. So the picture, the picture's like this. So you have the fluid tube, the drop, comes down, here's the interface, and it creates this thin film of fluid, of fluid one, that's separate. So as it even though it looks like it's sitting on the interface,
mm-hmm.
there's still a thin film of
right.
this fluid one separating them. That fluid one has to drain out of there
mm-hmm.
and takes on the order of minutes before there's actual coalescence.
Oh, so eventually?
Eventually it will coalesce. Eventually it will coalesce.
Thank you.
Yeah. Now, in your method, the problem is too much coalescence. So here we're going to do we're going to simulate the experiment. So actually the density ratio is 1.2, not 1.1. But we're going to take the same parameters as the experiment, at least the viscosity ratio of 0.33. And we're going to use a uniform mesh, which I'm not showing here. It's a finite element method with about 14,000 nodes. So more or less uniform mesh. This is the domain actually is further, it goes down a bit. Here's the drop, we're gonna start it off a little bit above the interface. go, and wonderfully, it merges. But it's wrong. So it looks beautiful. You get nice surface waves. The method changes topology without any problem, as Stan would say, emotional involvement. But the problem is that you have to be emotionally involved because it's wrong. And what's really going on is that your evolution on the large scale, before the drop gets close, is accurate. Everything's fine. The interface is fine. The drop is fine. But the problem is when you get into the near contact region where the drop is coming close to the lower interface, and then you have to resolve that aspect of the flow as well. Very natural. And so what you get is the unphysical coalescence. Now the problem is that if you try to use a uniform mesh, you would be wasting a lot of resolution because you only need to get that fine resolution while the gap is there. Here you don't need anything, really. And so the key is to use an adaptive mesh refinement. This is axisymmetric, thanks. Yeah, I should have said that. The experiment is not axisymmetric, roughly it looks axisymmetric until the actual coalescence. Yeah?
The reason the interface looks deformed at the start is because the drop had been falling sometime before we actually see.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Do you have a slow movie where you can actually see the coalescence of this case?
For the experiment?
No, just for this case.
I haven't.
Because it looks rather interesting anyway, even though it's wrong.
Right. Yeah. Right. No, I don't have a. No, we didn't do a slow one because it's for there. So this leads me then to talking about the method. So really, what we want to combine is an adaptive mesh refinement together with the Navier-Stokes equation, using the level set method and in the finite element framework. And so this is based on a couple of papers. This first one talking more about the mesh, and then this one talking about how that is combined with the Navier-Stokes and finite element solvers. So adaptive mesh refinement. So basically there's been a number of methods for adaptive refinement. And our approach here is to use unstructured meshes. So basically, in 2D, that means that we're going to use triangles. And so what that means is that from one time step to the next, the connectivity of the mesh, so what node is connected to what other node, can change completely. And so in 2D, and for the axisymmetric simulation I'll show, we're using triangles. And in 3D, we have tetrahedra. There's been other work using unstructured meshes and other approaches, as I mentioned, using mesh mapping methods, where basically you have a mapping that takes you from some uniform mesh to a deformed mesh. And you could also do structured mesh refinement, where the connectivity stays the same between mesh points from one time step to the next, where you basically would just divide, for example, using Cartesian unstructured mesh refinement. So there's these techniques. Now the unstructured meshes are going to give you the best approach, best mesh for the number of nodes, because you can using triangles and tetrahedra, you're able to capture much more complex geometries. For example, in the mesh mapping method or moving meshes, it's hard to add or subtract nodes because you're usually using a mapping. Right? And the structured mesh refinement, you would need more mesh points to capture a typical geometry. Yeah?
If the problem can be solved as an axisymmetric problem or can be modeled as an axisymmetric problem, why to solve it in 3D?
Oh, no reason. So I didn't solve it in 3D.
Oh, it's, yeah.
Yeah,
okay.
No, you would never do it unless you were doing it to test your 3D solver. But no. No, the 3D is for a different thing. I'll show you.
Yeah.
It's not for the drawing.
Yeah.
So the idea of adaptive mesh is deceptively simple. It's really based on work that Vittorio Cristini did a number of years ago now for adaptive surface meshes. And here, what has been done is the method has been modified. applied, so instead of doing a surface mesh, you do volume meshes, but the same types of principles. So think of a triangle. So basically you have the triangle, you have the nodes, and so we're going to regard the mesh as basically a series of springs that are connecting the nodes. And the springs are going to be overdamped, so they don't oscillate. So each spring, in other words, each edge length, is going to have an equilibrium or optimal length. And that optimal length is going to depend on the local length scales of the problem. Then, since you have springs, you can define a mesh energy function, which is basically just measuring the deviation of the edges from their equilibrium or desired values. And so the optimal mesh, given the desired values, which again depend on the local length scales, is going to be the global minimum of the energy. Now the problem is that if you just took this mesh, the mesh point, you know, again, the mesh is all connected by these springs, and you just try to minimize this energy by doing, let's say, equilibration, so in other words, making the nodes move to decrease this energy, you get stuck in local minimum. And you don't get a good mesh. So then what you have to do is do local refinement operations. So, for example, reconnecting nodes. So if your triangles get elongated, then you want to switch the connection and not have this be connected to that, but instead have this be connected to that. And that will lower the energy. And in addition, you want to add and subtract nodes, and that will lower the energy. And so the combined effect of these local operations will give you the global minimum, or at least get you close to the global minimum in energy. You don't have to be exactly at the minimum, but you want to make sure that your mesh is close to it. And you do this, again, with local operations. So everything is local, so it's not expensive. Now, that's fine, but the problem is that you could have a complex domain. So here the domain is not exactly complex, but it's axisymmetric. So from the point of view of the algorithm, in some sense, it is a little bit of a complex domain because we want to make sure that we do our boundaries correctly. So here's an example of in some sense, how we do the system. You take we put everything in a big box, and then we inside the box, we define our computational domain. So here the computational domain is this rectangle. It could have been something much more complicated. And now, when we have this rectangle, so we want to make sure that the points are, that our triangles in some sense, if we want to get boundary conditions right, don't go across the edges of this artificially imposed computational domain on top of the other one. And so what that means is that we have to do certain projections. So that, in other words, I described how you refine the mesh, but that refinement of the mesh might actually push these points over. So you have to push them back. And so, for example, we developed an algorithm. So this might happen. You might get a situation like this. So here is your boundary. And after the mesh refinement operation, so in other words, equilibration, local addition, subtraction, reconnection, you might generate a mesh that looks like this. And then what you need to do is project these mesh points back on the axis so that you can get the right boundary condition for these guys. And so basically it's a little complicated, but one can do that. Yes?
When you do that, do you get problems with getting triangles that are too skinny?
The answer is yes and no. You get triangles that are not optimal on this boundary, but they don't seem to cause any problem with the simulation. We haven't gotten anything that's too terrible. If you iterate this a couple times, then you'll get a better mesh on the edge. But you could run into that problem. But we haven't seen it really cause too much of a problem, or really any problem with the numerical method. And then this technique, it really is very general, can work in arbitrary geometry. So the next step is, once you define the mesh, and the next step is to figure out how you're going to solve the equation. And so to solve the equation, what we do is we use a distribution form of the system. So basically what that means is that we are going to include, so we write the Navier-Stokes equation, formally this looks the same, but the definition of the stress is different. The viscous stress and the pressure parts, contributions are all the same, but now we put the surface tension in through a singular surface force, or actually surface stress. And now the equations hold in the whole domain, but then this is a delta function that's supported on the surface sigma. And then we need to represent the interface. In particular, we have to define the normal vectors. And so you can do that using the level set representation, where basically the interface is the zero set of an auxiliary function phi. And then since the interface is the level set, the normal is nicely defined as grad over mod grad. And then one can use a standard form of the surface delta function, which is the one-dimensional delta function of phi, mod grad phi. So phi is supposed to be less than zero inside the drop and bigger than zero outside the drop and not going smoothly to zero at the drop boundary. In particular, one typically likes grad phi to be about one in magnitude. So phi, that means that phi is looking like a distance, the sine distance function to the interface. The interface should move with the fluid, and one then can impose that by asking that this interface moves with the fluid, but one simple way to do it is just to solve the advection equation. So advect the level set function with the fluid velocity, and this will move the interface with normally to the with the same normal velocity as the fluid. And as I mentioned, what typically one wants to do is make sure this grad phi is about one. What that prevents is basically artificial widening or narrowing of the interface. And so to do that, one solves an associated Hamilton-Jacobi equation that basically d is like d is like phi, but then we're evolving d so that through this equation, so basically that grad d is like one for a long enough time, and that basically serves to reinitialize and keeps the phi always like a distance function. Now to do the so that's the model, and now to do the discretization, what we did is that we use a finite element formulation and a projection type method, but it's like an Ozawa method. I won't go into the details here. The point is that it's an implicit method where we actually do iteration at each time step so that we can accurately take into account the inertial pieces, so in other words, the nonlinear piece u dot grad u, and also the incompressibility condition. And so this iteration scheme, you only typically have to do a few iterations at each time step, and then you get very accurate velocities in the sense that the divergence of the velocity is very nearly zero. If you only do one step, which would be a typical projection method, the divergence of the velocity might be far from zero, of O of H squared, which can cause problems for mass loss. And so some advantages of the scheme. So the discretization basically goes as follows. We use, so that was basically the time discretization, how we discretize in time. The spatial operators right now are continuous, so this is a semi-discrete scheme. But to do the spatial discretization, we use the finite element method, where we use mixed finite elements. So we use two techniques. We use the mini element, where you have piecewise linear pressures and piecewise linear plus a bubble function for velocity. And we also used P2, P1 combinations. discretization of the level for the level set method, we used a total variation diminishing Rogacata scheme and then a P1 representation, so piecewise linear, and P2 means piecewise quadratic representation of a level set function phi. And then for the surface tension term, we tried two different techniques. We used the formulation, the stress form, so that, in other words, using the singular stress, when you put this into weak form, you never need to compute the curvature, because you basically you put the derivative on the test function. So that's a nice aspect of the method. But you still have the singular stress, the delta function, so we actually try various things where we integrate explicitly over a piecewise linear surface, then you don't need to smooth it, or you could, because you do it in the weak formulation, or you can smooth the delta function. I think I'm going to show results mainly for the smoothing of the delta function, but they were very similar, it didn't make much difference. And at the same time, you smooth characteristic functions, and that's characteristic functions are what are distinguishing, for example, viscosity and density from the inside and outside fluid. The reinitialization, we use an explicit positive coefficient scheme. And then in the adaptive mesh, the resting length, so in other words, the desired length, what we do is we make that proportional to the distance to the interface. What I really mean by that is that we fix the smallest edge length near the interface, we fix the smallest edge length away from the interface, and we use the distance function to interpolate between them. So when s is zero, or basically, s is a slope. So when phi is zero, you're at the interface, okay, and you're going to choose the smallest edge length, and then this gives you a change in the smallest interface width, smallest edge width, or edge length away from the interface that's going to go from little h to capital H zero. That would be the mesh on the edge. So in other words, the smallest meshes are going to be near the interface, the largest meshes are going to be at the computational value. So a big advantage of using the adaptive method is that the cost is minimal among all, basically, a variety of a bunch of methods. So the reason for that is resolving a problem with an interface and you're refining only near an interface, the interface is going to be one dimension less than the whole volume. Okay, so the number of degrees of freedom, n, is going to be proportional to 1 over h, the smallest edge length, to the n minus 1, okay, if you're in the adaptive mesh, because you're resolving essentially only near the interface, whereas in if you had a uniform mesh, it'd be 1 over h to the n. And so what that gives you, if you assume that your solver cost is in 2D is n to the 1.25, so that's based on using the mini element, and 1.33 in 3D, this 1 over h comes from a CFL condition. So the total cost would be this, total cost would be this. So if you use this and convert everything to h's, then you find that you have an enormous savings using the adaptive method versus non-adaptive or even boundary integral. Okay, so in fact, the adaptive, unless you're doing really something special with the boundary integral, the adaptive method is going to beat everything. And the remeshing cost is really on the order, this lower order, h to the minus n minus 1, so it's on the lower, it's long compared to the solver cost. So just to give an example, if you're comparing the what happens if you go to a gap of 10 to the minus 3, adaptive versus non-adaptive, you're going to have a 6,000 in 2D, 6,000-fold reduction in CPU time. So enormous. So now, let's take the method and apply it to the drop interface impact. So what we have here, we'll first look at the results for this 0.33 viscosity ratio. And so what's shown is the experiment and the simulation at different times. And so you can see they're actually, so now there's excellent agreement between the experiment and the simulation. We don't have a picture here, we have it here and not there. But through this transition process, you see the drop come down, deform the interface, have this characteristic egg shape, and then it comes back up. I'll show you a bit more detail in a minute. So now let me show you how the simulation actually works. So here we have the drop, here we have the interface. This is the end of the computational domain, so it's not very deep. And this is the mesh. So you see the mesh is clustered around the interface, and also when this drop gets close to this lower interface, we're going to also refine additionally. So you'll see the mesh gets more points as it comes down. So now the drop is going to fall. You see how the mesh travels with the drop. Now it's going to deform the lower interface. You get very high resolution in this lubrication zone and comes back up and sits there. Yeah?
And if you keep the integrating, how does it do?
The
time for coalescence?
So basically what the so in here, in the I should have said, in the simulation, in the model, actually this, we don't have any van der Waals forces, and so van der Waals forces ultimately are what's going to cause the drop to break. So if we leave this running, what will happen at later times is the gap will drop to the region where there's the fluid here will get to a level that then becomes below our tolerance to resolve it, and then the drop will break, and you'll have coalescence. And so that's a tunable parameter now. And so we can control basically the time at which the drop is going to penetrate by controlling that smallest length. But now it's a controllable parameter. But if you run it for longer, it will eventually coalesce.
In the experiment, is that?
Well, the thing is, in the experiment, it depends. So in the experiment, it can be on the order of minutes. And so that, on this time scale, is too long for us to really continually refining it.
And at this stage, how many grid points do you have between the drop and the lower layer of fluid?
I believe there's at least 5 grid points between the drop and the lower layer.
So as this gets thinner and thinner and thinner, there are
so that's
more
why
and more grid points.
That's your tolerance. So for example, I was saying the mesh was being refined by this H close to the interface, and I just have to make that H smaller and smaller, which I can do. And the price I pay is it's more costly.
Yeah.
So that's why I say it's a tunable parameter. If I make that small, then I can watch this sit on the interface longer and longer. Okay. So essentially, the total number of mesh points on the interface in the simulation follows this graph. So this is time, and this is the total number of nodes in the simulation. So remember, the uniform mesh simulation I showed at the beginning, where the drop went beautifully through, was about 14,000. So here, as the time goes on, so first in the early stages, you don't need that many points until the drop is getting very close, and then we start refining the mesh, and eventually we go up above, and the maximum number is about close to 18,000, and then comes back down because the drop goes down and then gets a nicer shape. So the actual number of mesh points drops towards the end. But you see, over most of the calculation, you only need to use 4,000 mesh points. And you only need the high resolution as it's interacting. And that this is what the computational domain looks like at the time, basically in the close, when the interfaces are in close contact. So you can't see anything, because the mesh is so dense. So the drop is in here, and the interface is in here. And now what I'm going to do is blow up this box. Now, try to keep in mind this width. So I'm going to blow up. The largest mesh size here on the boundary is 2. The smallest mesh size in this simulation is 0.002. So if I blow this up 1,000 times, if I blow this guy up 1,000 times, I should see a mesh edge length like that, if everything is scaling correctly. So I blow it up once, and now you begin to see the drop in the interface. So 10 times I blew it up. Again, blew it up. And then I blew it up again. And so here's the interface, and here's the mesh. And so you see quite a nice mesh. And again, these edge lengths are very similar to what I had on the computational domain in the original scale. So the mesh is preserving the scale very nicely.
The interface is captured by the characteristic function, right?
Yeah, the level set function. So this is essentially the zero curve of the level set function.
And the level set function is defined on the nodes on this triangle?
Right, that's right. And it's interpolated to get this curve. And And so, so basically, you know, at this time, we're about 16,000 nodes. So not much more than the uniform mesh, but we got the right answer in some sense. And now we can do a quantitative comparison with the experiment, where we plot, where we really compare apples with apples. So what this is time, and this axis is interface position. And let me tell you which position. So the top curve, so and here's the lower interface. So what we're measuring is position along the axis of symmetry. The top curve is the position of the top of the drop. This curve is the position of the bottom of the drop. And then this curve is the position of the interface. And so the drop falls. And then you see the drop is falling. And then the lower interface is deforming. These curves are merging, or close to merging. Then they're following, so then they stay together. In the experiment, they stay together basically because they can't resolve that gap region with their imagery. But we can in the simulation, this is what we predict. And then as you come up, this is the rebound, and then likewise the rebound. And then certain of the features, certainly this part is captured very well. This has some small deviation, but then it goes back. This has some small deviation from the experiment. Here, I think this is probably an accuracy. But it's quite good quantitative agreement with a difficult experiment.
John, how
yes.
high can you run the Reynolds number?
So these, I'll show you, we've gone up to 300. So I'll show you close to the end what kind of ranges we've been able to do. Just if you want to look at the gap, this is a plot of the gap, the minimum distance between the drop versus time and the interface versus time. So the simulation is this blue curve, comes down and goes basically down to zero. This is a linear fit, so it looks for at least some range, it's linear. Then if you're looking close up into the more the near contact region, there's this deviation from linearity. Now, if we look at the, this is the smallest edge size, so it basically decreases, and the minimum distance goes to here, the smallest mesh size is this 0.02, so I said 5 is really 3 at that final time, and so if you did this in the uniform mesh, you'd use this many nodes, so a lot. Now we can say, well, what about the other experiment? So if we change the viscosity ratio, we change the parameters, the other parameters accordingly. This is the simulation. There it goes. So it's the drop is less deformed. It comes down and deforms the interface less, and then it comes up. And my and then I think this is the last time of the simulation, at least for this particular one. So it goes down and comes and sits on the interface, just again to show you that. So you see the mesh travels, even though the mesh is not moving, it's being, every time step is being refined, so effectively it's tracking the interface, or capturing the interface. And then we can, question, yeah?
Do you have to have a dense mesh on the interface before the drop touches the interface, down there?
What you need to have is, you need to have enough mesh points to resolve the lubrication zone.
Mm-hmm.
So however that's done, we did it by just simply refining the interface all around, refining the mesh all around the interface. We could have just refined the mesh in the gap region. Here's a comparison, again, visual comparison between the experiment and the simulation. Again, very good agreement. The numerical drop is slightly flatter. Here's a quantitative comparison with the, again, these interface positions. So the upper drop surface, the lower drop surface, and the interface. Again, the features are quite, they compare quite well. There is a bit of an offset here. I don't know exactly what that's due to, although in the simulation, you know, the drop hasn't reached a steady shape necessarily and a steady velocity before it's impacting, whereas in the experiment they drop it much higher. So the drop typically reaches a steady morphology and velocity. So that can be impacting things. But for example, up here, here I'm not exactly sure, but it's still reasonably close. Again, the gap appears to behave somewhat linearly in time. So in other words, decreases linearly until you get to the near contact region. Again, a close up. So now to basically go to your question, Rich, what kind of Reynolds numbers can you do? So now we have a simulation tool. So what we said then is, under what conditions can you actually get rebounding? So we had two experimental data points, but we can try to fill out the parameter space. And so what we did, there's essentially two parameters in the problem. There's other parameters. There's, of course, the viscosity ratio, the density ratio. There was also a Froude number. I can actually scale a Froude number out of the system. So in terms of the other parameters, there's the viscosity ratio, density ratio, Reynolds number, and Weber number. And if I fix the viscosity ratio and the density ratio, then I can see what happens as a function in terms of the Weber number and the Reynolds number. And so what we did is a parameter study where the experiment is this data point. And so then what we did is we varied the Reynolds number and the Weber number to try to determine the region for which you see rebound. And so it's essentially non-monotone in these parameters. There is a minimum, and then here at about Reynolds number 30, then as you decrease the Reynolds number, you can only go so far while seeing rebound, and then beyond this, you have no rebound. As you increase the Reynolds number, you have to also increase the Weber number, and then you get rebound up here. And to kind of give you a picture of what's going on, we can show you, I'll show you various simulation points. So for example, over here, at Reynolds number 5 and Weber number 7, what happens is this essentially looks like Stokes' flow because it's low Reynolds number. So the drop is just going to fall and sit on the interface. Okay, so it doesn't rebound, just goes down. It sits there because the flow is slow. And the Weber number is relatively low, so surface tension is strong. Now here, this is a point close to a transition, and so what happens is that this is basically the Weber number is a little bit lower, I think it's 3, and the Reynolds number is out a little bit bigger, it's 10. And if you look at this guy, so now you see it gets there and deforms it a little bit. So it's still sort of, it's not completely Stokes flow, but it deforms a little bit and bounces up. Now if you're over here, so at large Reynolds number, what happens is that as the drop falls, it basically doesn't see this interface until it's too late and just tries to go right through. Down, deforms it, and then after this it breaks. Okay, and so here the inertia is too strong, and it just goes right through. And let me show you one other point, which is this so-called critical point, which is in between, this case and in this case, so now you see a lot of deformation because it's large Reynolds number and large Weber number, so the drop deforms a lot. And it appears it's going to want to rebound, but it merges there. And so it's, if I had instead increased the Weber number a little bit, then I get to rebound. Okay.
What Reynolds number does axis symmetry break down?
That's a good question. I don't know. It's experimental. Yeah, I don't know. So, but these are the typical things on this. So you need a combination in order to get the rebound, a combination of the Reynolds and Weber number. Okay, so you basically you need, given a, as you increase the Reynolds number, you need to increase the Weber number, and is from some minimum value. And as you decrease the Weber number, you also decrease the Reynolds number. You also have to increase the Weber number. Yeah.
How expensive do the calculations get?
Good question. So this original, so the one that took the longest, because we wanted to resolve the most, is this guy from the experiment. That took about 6 days.
On what kind of machine?
Just a PC, like a Pentium PC. Okay, so let me conclude. The theme is that the mesh refinement is really necessary to capture complex interactions. If your simulations can look beautiful if you're using uniform meshes, but if you're trying to look at interactions of things, then the uniform mesh will break down when you stop resolving the length scale. In other words, the lubrication length scale, and it can give you inaccurate results. So future work, we're going to continue the studies, extend to 3D, I'll show you a little bit more, and extend to really complex geometry. So this was axisymmetric. We can do channels and this kind of thing very accurately with this mesh, including van der Waals forces, so that we really can accurately describe coalescence. And then we've also been working on coupled methods, where this may be even online now, an adaptive coupled level set volume of fluid method. So working with Ashley James and her student Yang, where we couple the adaptive mesh, the adaptive method here for level set, with a volume of fluid. And in that way we can very, very accurately conserve mass. In these simulations, mass was conserved quite accurately by always adding a small correction at each time step. Just to close, let me show you why we do 3D, and not for the job, but for example, if you had a thread of fluid and you wanted to